Funding for Here and Now Anytime comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Hi, this is Here and Now Anytime, where we give you a little news, a little something you weren't expecting, and always a fresh, in-depth perspective on current events, arts and culture, and stories that matter. Subscribe or follow to get all our episodes out every weekday. And if you like what you hear, leave us a review to help spread the word. Now here's the show.
It is a balanced plan that tackles emissions, bridges the gap on adaptation, reimagines global finance, and delivers on loss and damage.
They're calling it the UAE Consensus on Climate Change. Less oil someday. It's Wednesday, December 13th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Today on the show, tonight is peak viewing for the Geminid meteor shower. How to see it, and what you're missing, if you can't. Also, you might not think of the Coast Guard as an immigration agency, but off the shores of Florida, Coast Guard agents are intercepting and detaining thousands of migrants, including kids traveling alone. We'll go inside the largely unseen system of immigration enforcement at sea.
The number of people in general taking to the sea, primarily from Haiti and Cuba, really spiked to levels we hadn't seen in nearly three decades.
But first, after days of negotiation at the UN Climate Conference in Dubai, COP28, world leaders have a deal. It's a compromise, but it's still the first time ever they're calling on the world to transition away from fossil fuels. The plan stops short of calling for a total phase out of fossil fuels. And it's a disappointment to some activists and developing nations in other ways, too. But it's remarkable in a couple ways as well, not least that the first global agreement to reduce fossil fuel use came out of the summit hosted by an oil country and presided over by an oil executive. Well, for a wrap-up about what it all means, we called up Navina Sadasivam of GRIST. She spoke to Scott Tong from Dubai.
Now, on fossil fuels, some wanted the summit to agree to a phase out, whereas in the end, the countries agreed to transition away from coal and oil and natural gas. These are all words, of course. In practical terms, what does transitioning away mean?
Yeah, absolutely. So phase out was always the strongest language on the table, and there were a whole bunch of other options that were being discussed, including phase down, substitution, for example. In this context, what transition away does is it sends a signal that the world is collectively moving away from the use of fossil fuels. And the text also has language about tripling renewable energy and doubling energy efficiency. And so combined, what the signal that is sent out from this text is that the world is moving away from the use of fossil fuels and moving towards cleaner energy systems.
And then as far as this signal, right, people in the markets, energy markets, often talk about signals. How might this rhetorical signal translate into actual, you know, wind energy, speeding up electric cars, or shutting down natural gas plants?
Right. And I think the hope here is that financial systems, people in banking institutions see this sort of global call. This is an agreement that has been signed by 200 countries. And so they will see this text, the hope is that they will see this text as a plan for the future of this is how countries see the future of the world. And so that they might shift their own investments, that investors, when they're deciding where to put their money, might make decisions along those lines so that they're not investing in, let's say, oil pipelines or natural gas infrastructure. And we're seeing that a little bit this morning. Oil prices have slumped slightly. And that has happened in previous years in Glasgow when there was an agreement to move away from coal. Coal prices dropped dramatically. So that's what we mean when we say we want to send a signal to the markets.
Mm-hmm. Now, these decisions, you know, I've covered a couple of these meetings before. They're made by consensus, so every country has to agree in the language. And these resolutions are often non-binding. So is there any penalty for countries that are seen as not transitioning away from fossil fuels quickly enough?
Right. So there isn't a strict penalty in the sense of clear enforceability and accountability. Those systems don't exist in this kind of process. This is entirely a voluntary process that countries are signing up to. It's a multilateral process, right? And so any sort of enforceability comes from political pressure on the ground domestically in these countries.
Hmm. Now, also at this meeting, rich countries pledged $700 million for what's called loss and damage to help developing countries affected by climate change. Boy, that sounds like a fraction of what's been called for in the past.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I think the estimates are anywhere between $300 and $500 billion a year by 2030. That's the need in terms of loss and damage. And this is just a drop in the bucket. But at the same time, I want to say that, you know, no other fund has seen capitalization at this speed and at this rate. So that in itself is a success. It is just a drop in the bucket. It's a starting point. But the hope is that more funds will be raised through in the coming years.
Yeah. And at this summit, of course, the scientists told us the world is still on track to significantly overshoot the climate goals. Navina Sadasivam from GRIST, staff writer, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
As we've heard, the plan is to transition away from fossil fuels. And to do that, world leaders agreed to ramp up use of a technology that will capture and remove planet-warming carbon from the atmosphere. And here now just wrapped up a week-long series on this very topic. So we have Peter O'Dowd as part of our team on the line. Hi, Peter.
Hey, Scott.
So, Peter, this is about net zero. We keep hearing net zero. Does that mean, practically speaking, still allowing power plants and factories that burn fossil fuels, but just catching, trapping the carbon emissions before they go out the smokestack?
Yeah, that's certainly one way to do it. And this is absolutely about net zero, which is based on this belief, essentially, that the world can't just wake up one day and move to a 100% clean economy overnight. So in the meantime, you've got to do something to offset that pollution from the coal plant or the tailpipe in your car. Now, Navina mentioned the text of the agreement. Right there in the document, it says that after countries of the world transition away from fossil fuels to reach net zero by 2050, the very next line says that countries should accelerate the use of technology to remove and capture carbon and then store it away. So clearly, it's not the only solution here, but it's going to play a pretty big role.
Yeah. Well, one way to do this, as you say, is to capture and remove CO2 from factories, industrial facilities, shove it underground. But carbon removal is also part of this, I gather, taking the CO2 out of the air. You and our colleague Chris Bentley reported on this. What is the promise, Peter? What are the limits?
Yeah, carbon removal, different from carbon capture. So Chris and I went around the country looking at different projects where they're taking the carbon right out of the air. Chris met people who are sinking it to the bottom of the ocean with wood and algae. There are farmers out there that are sprinkling rock dust into their soil. It absorbs carbon. I went to the only direct air capture plant that just opened in California in November. They're sucking the carbon out of the air like a vacuum. So the problem here is scale and cost. We have exactly one commercial scale direct air capture plant. It's the one I saw. It started in November. It'll suck 1,000 tons of CO2 out of the air a year. So when COP leaders say they need to accelerate this technology, they're not exaggerating. They really do.
Yeah, well, I can imagine some saying, well, listen, we need new technologies. They're not all there yet. Every solution has trade-offs. But what is the more critical view of this?
The more critical view is that carbon removal and storage technology makes the problem worse. After today's deal, I called up Mark Jacobson. He's a professor at Stanford. He says, we don't need net zero. We have to have zero emissions flat out. And so, he says this plan to transition away means that you have to support carbon capture and removal. It's a technology that the fossil fuel industry supports. It's technology that keeps fossil fuels in business because it basically means you're not using the power and the energy to replace all these natural gas and coal plants. So it just adds emissions to the atmosphere.
That's here now. It's Peter O'Dowd. Peter, thank you.
You're welcome.
By the way, that reporting Scott and Peter were talking about, it's all here on Here and Now Anytime. Scroll back to last week's episodes if you missed any of them. Every day, we've got something worth hearing, so check it out. And read more about all of it at hereandnow.org. Coming up next, migrants fleeing violence and unrest in their home countries often travel thousands of miles to come to America. Some risk their lives traveling through dangerous conditions, only to be turned back by U.S. immigration enforcement. That's a familiar story, but what's less reported is the number of people making that journey by sea. After the break, we'll hear from a reporter who investigated the largely unseen system of immigration enforcement off the shores of Florida by the U.S. Coast Guard. Scott has the story when we return.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's TELADOC health/whatsyourwhy. This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive, and it's Name Your Price tool. Say how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show coverage options within your budget. Visit Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. This message comes from NPR sponsor Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com.
You may not think of the Coast Guard as an immigration agency, but off the shores of Florida, Coast Guard agents are intercepting and detaining thousands of migrants, including kids traveling alone. Most are from Haiti, and ever since that country's president was assassinated 2 years ago, the Coast Guard has detained more than 27,000 people at sea and processed them on ships far away from public view. But Seth Fried Wessler investigated this system for our editorial partners at ProPublica, and he joins us now to talk about it. Hi, Seth.
Thanks for having me on.
So from July 2021 to September 2023, the number of children without parents or guardians held by the Coast Guard spiked by 10 times, 10x. You followed a few of them. First of all, help us understand, who are these children? What lives are they trying to escape?
Yeah, you know, beginning in the summer of 2021, the number of people in general taking to the sea, primarily people from Haiti and Cuba, and trying to reach the United States really spiked to levels that we hadn't seen in nearly three decades. And hundreds of those people were unaccompanied children. They, like everyone else, are detained aboard Coast Guard cutters, and then most of them are sent back where they left. And the story largely follows a 10-year-old boy named Jerry, who had left Haiti to follow his mother first to the Bahamas and then tried to reach Florida, was held aboard one of these Coast Guard ships for 5 days and sent back to Haiti.
And I do want to ask more about Jerry. But first of all, the Coast Guard, you write that it is effectively doing border control on the ocean, but it's much different from border control at the land crossings, isn't it? One Coast Guard spokesperson told you that asylum does not apply at sea.
That's right. The rules of immigration at sea are vastly different from those that apply on land, in that people don't have a right, a legal right, to claim asylum when they're held aboard United States Coast Guard cutters. So the U.S. government has set up a different system for people to try to claim protection aboard these Coast Guard ships, but nearly nobody makes it through, and that includes children. Children on land who arrive alone are provided pretty vast protections, are assigned government caseworkers, sometimes put into shelters, reunited with family. That's really not true at sea. In fact, only about 1% of children were allowed onto land in the United States because U.S. officials believed that they might face harm if they were returned to their countries.
Mm. Is it clear to you, Seth, why the systems are so different?
You know, in the early 1980s, the United States formalized its asylum and refugee rules. Congress passed new legislation to do that. But shortly after that, there were huge numbers of Haitians who were leaving a brutal dictatorship. And at that point, the federal government implemented new restrictions and new policies that sent the Coast Guard into the sea to intercept people before they landed in Florida. Consecutive administrations have tightened those rules, and now we're left with a system where the sea is a profoundly different kind of place for people who are fleeing harm and danger in the countries they live in.
Seth, your article, as you mentioned, follows a number of people, principally this 10-year-old boy, Jerry. Tell us more about what you learned about his journey, who was around him, what the conditions were like.
Yeah, Jerry's a 10-year-old boy who left Haiti several years ago to follow his mother. His father was murdered in Haiti, and his mother left for the Bahamas. And he followed her and then followed her again to the United States. On that journey by boat, the United States Coast Guard stopped him and the dozens of other people he traveled with, and he was brought aboard a series of United States Coast Guard cutters and held there. People on these cutters are held on the open deck of these military ships, hard metal decks exposed to sun and rain and sea spray. The ships, and everybody agrees, really aren't made to act as holding platforms or detention centers, but that's what they've been used for. And Jerry, as well as two other young girls, two sisters, were on the boat with nobody that they knew. As I write in this story, they were delivered back to Haiti with absolutely no plan to figure out where they would go or what would happen to them. And so Jerry, a 10-year-old boy, ended up leaving the port in Haiti, where they were dropped by the U.S. Coast Guard, with a man that he barely knew, who he had actually met in a smuggler's safe house in the Bahamas, and who decided aboard one of these cutters that he would take responsibility for this little boy who had nobody aboard this boat. And so Jerry ended up spending months living with this man named Peterson until finally he made it over a dangerous land route to his grandmother, who he hadn't seen for many years since he left Haiti. He's now there, and his parents, who traveled to Canada, are trying to figure out some way to bring him. But he really has a very, very uncertain future at this point. Well,
and harrowing chronicling of his journey that you've done in this article. Seth, how is all this affecting the Coast Guard? Right, they frame their work as life-saving, rescuing people from dangerous seas and overcrowded boats. What have you learned about the people doing this Coast Guard work and whether they have the resources they need?
I talked to a lot of people who work in the Coast Guard, and what I heard from many of them is that the work of having to detain and then return over and over again is taking a really mighty toll on people who work in this service. They say to me that's especially true for unaccompanied minors, who they sometimes spend many days with out in the open sea and almost universally have to send back to the countries they've left. And they talk about what one person called a moral dilemma that has emerged for people who many times didn't join expecting to operate effectively as a border patrol in the sea. Mm. You know, these Coast Guard cutters have turned over the last several years into sites of real crisis. People, because the asylum rules are so rigid and because people are so desperate to try to make it to the United States where they can try to claim asylum, have taken in some cases to actually harming themselves, trying to stab themselves with smuggled blades or swallow cotter pins that they pull from the decks of these ships in order that the Coast Guard decides they have to be rushed to a hospital on land where they hope they can claim asylum. For people who work in the Coast Guard, seeing that kind of thing, hearing the stories that people tell about why they left takes a real toll, and they're struggling. They struggle often to continue doing that work.
Yeah. And finally, Seth, you write about this system, right, where the members of the Coast Guard are operating effectively as border control, this system where many unaccompanied children, you know, find themselves in harrowing conditions, trying to get to the U.S. for various reasons. As you say, most of them get sent back. Why is this system largely unknown?
You know, one of the things that's true about immigration enforcement at the land border or inside of the United States is that it's often closely watched by the press, by lawyers, by advocates, by courts. And by virtue of the fact that the sea is invisible to most of us, we really don't very often get to see what's happening out there. So part of what I tried to do in this story is really to allow people to see what's happening aboard these Coast Guard cutters that are a major part of our immigration enforcement system. And I did that by talking to dozens of people who've been detained on these cutters and to people who work in the U.S. Coast Guard, to really try to get as close as I could to a system that until now has remained largely invisible.
Seth Fried-Wessler is a reporter for ProPublica. We will link to his story about unaccompanied migrants, mostly from Haiti, in the U.S. Coast Guard at hereandnow.org. Seth, thanks for the time.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, if you missed the Perseid meteor shower in August, you've got another chance to glimpse a cosmic light show. Tonight is peak viewing for the Geminids. Robin Young has more after the break.
This message is brought to you by NPR sponsor Progressive Insurance. You call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. Tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options within your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, an automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy shares why Betterment believes cash can be a strategic choice.
There are times when the market is volatile, when customers are a little nervous about investing. We came to understand that there was an opportunity to introduce cash as part of an investing strategy and to give back yields to the customer.
Learn more about high-yield cash accounts at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance not guaranteed. Cash reserve offered through Betterment LLC and Betterment Securities. Betterment is not a bank. Support for NPR and the following message come from Bombas. Bombas makes absurdly soft socks, underwear, and T-shirts. And for every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness. Get 20% off your first purchase at bombas.com/NPR and use code NPR.
The most incredible meteor shower of the year is happening now. The Geminids, which should be named Geminides because they're named after that constellation. But anywho, it reaches its peak tonight and tomorrow. The moon is just a sliver and sets early, so if skies are clear, bundle up, head outside. It could be spectacular. And to get more direction, here's Kelly Beatty, senior editor of Sky and Telescope. Hi there.
Hey, Robin.
So we know the Perseids in August. Tell us about the Geminids.
The Geminids are an unusual meteor shower because they're not created by a comet like the Perseids are. Instead, this is due to an asteroid called Phaethon, which circles the sun very tightly, comes as close as 13 million miles to the sun, gets to 1,300 degrees on its surface. And because of that, we think it's little particles are being blasted off by sunlight, and it's those little particles spread along its orbit that we plow through every December.
Okay, and when you say plow through, it's us spinning along on Earth. We're actually plowing through it, but it gives the appearance of falling on us like a shower of shooting stars?
Yeah, not falling. 20 miles a second, these particles are hitting our atmosphere. And so they hit very high up, you know, 80 miles up, 60, 80 miles, and they create a superheated white streak in the atmosphere. That's what we see as a meteor. It's the little incineration of those particles.
Okay, and where do we look?
Anywhere in the sky that it's dark.
Really?
So Gemini itself is in the east after sunset, like 9 o'clock, it'll be a third of the way up. All the meteors will appear to radiate from the sky from that point. But where you want to look is wherever your sky is darkest. That could be straight up. It could be, you know, to the south. Wherever it's darkest, get away from city lights. Turn off the porch light. Let your eyes get adjusted to the dark. And you might see up to one meteor per minute tonight or tomorrow night.
And we know that some towns are actually trying to get the less light pollution in the skies for viewing like this. You can always go to your town officials and remind them of that. But why do we understand that the Geminids can sometimes be different colors?
Because of the particles, if they're large enough, they create a streak that's bright enough to actually trigger a color response in our eye. You know, most of what we see at night in the nighttime sky, it's a black and white sky because we use a different kind of visual system at night, our night vision. But if it gets bright enough, then we can see a bright color and different colors in these meteors.
Okay, so it's been going on for a while. Tonight and tomorrow are like the big show to get out there for it.
And the later you can stay up, the better. Or if you stay up past midnight, you'll see more.
Okay, or get up really super early.
Or super early.
And by the while we're looking up, what else might you look for in December?
Well, while you're getting ready, by the way, make sure you dress warmly.
Right.
Jupiter is brilliant. Just look up as soon as it gets dark. It's the brightest thing in the sky. Jupiter's a half a billion miles away, but it's still the biggest planet. Very easy to spot right now.
Yeah.
And coming up in a few months, April 8th is the big one. That's the total solar eclipse of the sun that's going to cross the U.S. The last time that will happen until 2045. So you need to really plan for this one. And it's a Monday. Take the day off.
Right. Or, you know, make travel plans because people travel to see it at the best place. Kelly Beatty, senior editor of Sky and Telescope. We know what we're going to be doing tonight and tomorrow. Looking for the Geminids. It should be Geminides. I'm sorry. But,
it's okay. Whatever works for you.
Okay. Kelly, thanks so much.
A pleasure always, Robin.
That's our show. Here and Now Anytime comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories were produced by James Mastromarino, Julia Corcoran, and me, Chris Bentley. Today's editors were Todd Munt, Peter O'Dowd, and Kat Welch. Technical direction from Mike Moschetto and Caleb Green. Theme music by me, Mike, and Max Liebman. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. And the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the NPR Wine Club. NPR Wine Club members have contributed over $1.5 million to helping create a more informed public. Be 21. Join the charge at nprwineclub.org/podcast. This message comes from NPR sponsor Homes.com. The right agent can make or break your home search. That's why Homes.com provides an agent directory that details each agent's experience so you can find the right one and ultimately the right home. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
All that sitting and swiping, your body is adapting to your technology. Learn how and what you can do about it.
I really felt like the cloud in my brain kind of dissipated. Once I started realizing what a difference these little breaks were making, there's no turning back for me.
Take NPR's Body Electric Challenge. Listen to the series wherever you get your podcasts.